You know, it's like, how do you define how you win? And I have never been motivated by money. I do not define how I win by money. I have a great life. I feel really good about what I offer. I offer substance and quality. I love teaching. I love writing. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. For me to be in a position to look back on my 25-year career and take the stuff that I learned, you know, I took notes the whole way. That's what makes me different, you know, teacher than everybody else. I took notes. I went through this stuff. I was on the front lines the entire time. And I made every mistake possible. And I came from nothing. So I can identify with everybody.
Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How to Succeed in Marketing When Everyone Else Wants to See You Fail, an interview with copywriting legend John Carlton. Years ago, John Carlton met his first copywriter while working in the art department at a catalog company and asked her how to do copywriting. She told him it was way too hard and that he would never figure it out. John made the decision that day that not only was he going to make it, but he wasn't going to withhold the secrets of his success from anyone after he did. According to John, people naturally love grief, so you're probably not going to find many people in your fan club, your neighbors, your brother-in-law, maybe even your own spouse will secretly hope you fail and will delight in your misfortune. But overcoming adversity is what every guru has to do to make it, and you can do it too. So in this interview, you'll hear John Carlton take on questions from HardToFindSeminars.com listeners, and unlike the copywriter he met years ago, John doesn't hold anything back. You'll also learn how to connect with your audience and become their go-to guy, how to get your foot in the door with copywriting, John's influences and resources he learned about along the way, how to break into a more affluent market by showing the value of your service. You'll learn which is better, direct response or email, and whether or not you should bother with old school methods like space ads. You'll learn how to get targeted traffic to your website. You'll learn how to market your services to small businesses in a struggling economy. You'll learn 3 ways to identify the hot buttons in any marketplace. According to John, if you're looking for reasons to fail, you'll find them. And many people use the economy as an excuse to give up trying. But the good news is, nothing beats straightforward salesmanship. So if you show people the value in your product, you'll succeed in any economy and against all odds. And in this interview, you'll hear how to do that. Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online, downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. John, here's a question from Marco. He says, in copywriting, it is extremely important to find out who you are writing for. With direct mail, you can get a lot of the customer profile from data cards, etc., but I find it much harder to find out the target customer for online copywriting. Any feedback on that?
A few years ago, some of the guys who had one foot in the old world of direct mail and the other foot in the new world of online direct response marketing realized what a boon the web was to this kind of research, and they came up with something called an ASK campaign, A-S-K. And these are cheap, fast, and you can do them literally on the cuff from your kitchen table. Just merely, if you have a group of people who are in the target audience that you might be going after, just ask them, what would they like to see in a product? How are they disappointed about the products they're currently getting? You can ask them anything, and they will respond. As you and I both know, people like the interactive nature of the web. This kind of response, sending out a question, you know, you can give people a reward, or you can develop some kind of bonding with them to get this kind of interaction going back and forth, or you can actually do like a pay-per-click campaign to bring people in and ask them questions in exchange for some free information. There are a lot of ways to do this. There are companies like SurveyMonkey.com, which have very official-looking survey software available, or you can just do it on the cuff. I do it on my blog all the time just by saying, hey, I got to ask you guys a question, and I ask the question, and we talk about things. Sometimes I'll offer a reward, like a free copy of my course or something like that for the best answer, and I'll just get swamped with answers. People come in, and they're very sincere, it's very true, and these are some of the best kind of responses you can get. In direct mail, that would have taken me months to be able to get the information I can get literally overnight.
When you offer an ethical bribe compared to not offering, what kind of difference in response do you see?
Very interesting. The first couple times on the blog, I would say offhand, and this is not scientific, probably 4 times the response minimum with a bribe. And the first time I did it, I said, I'll give away a free copy of my kick-ass copywriting secrets to the best answer as judged by me. I asked a very specific question, and the responses just start piling up within minutes of me posting the blog because of the RSS feed. A lot of people get alerted to my post right away. I let it go on for 4 days, and I wound up giving away 5 of the awards rather than 1 because I just had so many good answers. I realized that, wow, you know, these people were responding thinking they were all competing for 1 prize, and even though they could look and see that there were almost 200 responses. And these are not short responses. These are like essay-type responses. So these are people that invested 15 minutes to an hour in the response.
Do you remember specifically what that case was about? So when you got all those responses, they gave you great content if you left it up there for your blog, number one. You could use the content if you were developing or writing a sales campaign. What else could you do with that information?
In fact, Michael, I don't remember the exact question, but I do remember what I wanted to get from it. I was just starting to plan the launch of my Simple writing system at home workshop. And I was looking for what people thought was the main element, I believe, in the sudden and rapid rise of most of the top marketers. Because I hang out with a lot of the top marketers online, the top entrepreneurs and small businessmen. It's just part of the group I hang out with. And I know the inside stories on them. All I know what was the primary motivation that drove guys from that kind of gray area of maybe being successful or certainly being unsuccessful to kind of jump that gap from being middling to not successful at all to being wildly successful. The main motivation behind that, I made people guess, and I teased them mercilessly in my post. And I said, I will give a price and the best answer. Now, what I was looking for was I knew what the answer was. What I was looking for was what people thought the answer was. And that information I was able to use to be able to counter objections when I wrote a later piece of selling the product. I didn't mention the product, by the way, but when I was doing this, I started realizing what people thought about what it took to become successful. And that gave me incredible insight into how people who were on the other side of the divide, the ones who hadn't been successful yet, thought about what it took to get over there. And that was a wealth of information because it led me into the thinking process, it led me into the belief systems that a lot of people had, and I was able to speak their language then when I was talking to them about how I could actually help them get from where they were to where they wanted to be, on that other side of the divide, so to speak.
Just on a side note, how did your launch for the Simple Writing System go?
Oh, it was wildly successful.
So you hit it right on the head.
I'll just say this. We went against the grain. I know Jeff Walker personally. He's a friend of mine. He's the guy that invented the launch formula. And I was talking with him, and he was just chilling me to the bone because he said, everything I'm doing is going against the grain. We're trying to do it in a much shorter time period. We're trying to sell copywriting help, which is traditionally fails in launches, and we were offering substance, essentially. And he said, you know, it's not necessarily that you're going to fail, but just know that you've got on a steeper hill than other people have to climb. And we knew that going in. So our secret weapon has always been superior marketing skills and writing skills. And, of course, that was what I was selling, was if you have these skills, you know, anything you do is going to be much better. So it was kind of like a real-world promise type thing. I don't know if you followed that, but I also had a challenge in there where a guy challenged me. We had essentially a two-week launch period where I was doing a lot of interviews with people. One of those was a challenge by a guy named Telman Knudsen, who said, hey, I have an underperforming weak limp site that isn't doing very well. We spent 6 months trying to fix it. We can't fix it. I challenge you to do what you say you do and fix it. And I spent half an hour with him and taught his rookie copywriter, who only had 5 months experience writing. The guy had no marketing or business experience before that at all. And I told him what to do according to the system. And they did it, and they tested it for 1 week. And they were going to come back. We were going to finish the interview. So this was live, no-net marketing theater. And I was a little nervous because I was putting my rep on the line there. But, you know, the secret weapon is always that I know this stuff works. So I got this guy what to do. I just told him essentially what to do. They went out and they tested it during the first week of the economic crisis when the Dow lost, what, 50% almost. That horrible, turbulent week. That's when they tested. They came back and what I told the guy to do, doubled response. Went from a 1.7 to a 3.4 sales conversion, which meant an extra $250,000 a month for Telman because of the quality of traffic he was getting.
Wow, that's incredible. That recording, was that a promotional recording or was that available? For more information, go to johncarltonoffer.com. That's johncarltonoffer.com.
We spent 2 weeks giving away content. In other words, I did that challenge. And by the way, we're going to do a lot more challenges now because they're fun, and I kind of like being challenged. I mean, nobody who's on the upper end of the entrepreneurial or the small business world likes boredom. But I interviewed everybody else. I interviewed Evan Tigg and Frank Kern, Stephen Pierce, Richard Sheffrin, and got them to put up copy that they had written after being inspired by me. I mean, I'd helped all these guys at some point. But it wasn't just testimonial interviews. We actually dove into the copy and kind of tore it apart and did a reverse engineering on it. You know, here's why they use this. Here's how that worked. You know, here we experimented with video here. We took the video off. Did some of these things like that. So it was all very content-driven and no selling at all, of course. So it was about a week and a half of the most intense giveaway of content that the market had really seen in a while.
Wow, that sounds great. Is that accessible anymore?
We took it off. It, of course, is not going to disappear. We haven't quite yet recovered from the launch. When people hear this talk, I'm not sure what time period is going to be, but there will be opportunities. So the main thing is to just stay in touch with what we're doing because we will not sit on that stuff. It's way too valuable. But we did, as part of the agreement that we had, during this Simple Writing System launch, it is off the market right now.
All right, let's move on to the next question. A question from Brandon Wilkins of the Financial Freedom Builders.com asks, I'm a financial coach and educator who shows people how to take control of their finances. I'm not flashy and I don't visibly flaunt how well I'm doing financially. I'm looking to break into a more affluent market, high wage earners. What suggestions do you have for how to appeal to that market when at first glance they won't see how valuable my techniques are?
Well, you know, this is very interesting. I get this a lot. The first thing to do is to realize, and I think there are other questions that are going to tie into this, it's all about salesmanship. And my little saying that I like to tell people, I say it over and over again, I have a lot of these little homilies, is if you have a product or a service that your prospect can actually use to make his life better, then shame on you if you don't do everything in your power to be able to make him see that the most logical next step he has in his life is to buy from you. And that shocks a lot of people because most people do what I call selling from their heels. They are reluctant to brag. They are reluctant to do what they perceive as hype. They are reluctant to get involved in any kind of aggressive selling. And what I mean by selling from your heels is that imagine a guy face-to-face trying to sell you something and he's got 1 foot turned sideways ready to bolt in the opposite direction. He says something like, here's what I got. It's really good, but you probably don't want to do it. That's the way most marketers do it. I teach people to stand up, be that guy your prospect needs you to be so that he can feel feel confident getting involved in your world, whether that's buying your product, using your services, leaving his email and name on your site as part of a name squeeze. Just figure out, who do you need to be? And I talk a lot about the go-to guy. Even the smallest entrepreneur in the world could be the go-to guy in his niche. If he understands the people better, I mean, you can go up against IBM and beat them. Because on a website, for example, if somebody's looking at your website, they're not looking at another website, they're looking at yours. It's you and him. It's just you and him talking, and you have an opportunity to beat out the biggest, most well-funded, well-staffed competitor if you can connect with him on a human-to-human level and be the go-to guy. Be that guy that he's going to think, oh, thank God I know who this guy is. What a great resource this guy is. He thinks like me. He's looked into the stuff. He's got more information. He's going to shortcut a lot of the process for me, and he has the answers that I want. So by being the go-to guy, you are that conduit to a world that your prospect either has no access to or is at a stage where he can piggyback on your experience or your deeper knowledge or your willingness to spend time doing what he hasn't got time to do, which may be just research. I mean, take hobbies. Like, say you're into HO trains. To be a go-to guy in that market, you just know more about HO trains than the average prospect out there. You're willing to share it, and you become that guy who allows the prospect to indulge in his passions to the degree he wants to and feel that he's dealing with somebody who not only shares his passions, but actually has more time to spend on the passion, has more insight to it, has done the footwork to be able to do things. So a lot of people get to guru status, so to speak, merely by saying, I'll be that guy who takes the risk and does more research than other people have time to do it, do all stuff, and call the people in this market and become friends with them. I have a good friend named Joe Polish who started out as a carpet cleaner, you know, and that's where he found Gary Halbert. He found me through that, Dan Kennedy, guys like that. And he just learned how to market. He became the most successful carpet cleaner in Phoenix, and then he decided he was going to teach other guys how to do what he did. So he took the marketing skills that he learned from top marketing experts, translated it to the carpet cleaning industry, became a millionaire doing that, then became a guru. So he stopped cleaning carpets and started teaching other carpet cleaners all over the world how to do this. Through that, he started things like the Genius Network. He started interviewing people like Albert, like me, like Kenny. Then he started branching out and started interviewing, who's that guy behind Virgin Airlines?
Richard Branson.
Richard Branson. He's best friends with Richard Branson.
Are you serious?
He's good friends with Tony Robbins. He got involved with the guys over at Nightingale Conan. They got to meet the Suns. I mean, he doesn't muck around with the Lopez. He goes straight to the top. When that book, The 4-Hour Workweek, came out, Seth Ferris, he just called him up and said, how would you like to be interviewed by this? And the guy was fine, and they became friends. So Joe's a very friendly guy. I like him a lot. I consider him a personal friend. I speak at his events a lot. I go out to his brainstorms. He's one of those guys who's a connector. I've met a lot of the top people in the industry at Joe's office in Phoenix. I'll fly out to Joe's office. There'll be six other guys there, four of which are some of the top marketers in the world. And so this guy came out of obscurity merely by raising his hand and saying, I'll tell you what, I'll be a guy in this carpet cleaning world who will go forward and not only learn how to make money and do all this stuff, I'll come back and I'll share it with you. Plus, I'll go to the extra step of, I'll just keep going and going and going because there's no limit to this, and get involved with things like, how did Virgin Airlines make this work, you know, and so, you know, he just spent a week on Necker Island with Richard Branson, and gets to know all these guys, and now he's moved out of the carpet cleaning business. He still has that at the side, but he is now a major player in the general marketing, especially online business. So he's kind of moved up in the world, but he's never forgotten his carpet cleaning roots, and again, it's just a great example of how anybody who just has a passion, he parlayed a passion for marketing and finding out things he didn't know and sharing them with other people, and just turned it into a career. He's definitely going to be one of the who's who of internet marketing when they start talking about this 100 years from now, about how internet marketing got going. We really are still in that gold rush period, you know, with the guys who are setting down standards for how internet marketing happens right now. Those standards will probably be there for a very, very long time, several generations. These are smart guys who are applying stuff, making it work, testing it, and they're essentially creating the landscape of internet marketing right now. And it's happening right now, and you're hanging out with these guys. It's like hanging out with the robber barons of the late 1800s that formed the industrial age that shot America to the top of the ranks of world powers.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's Hard to Find Seminars. com. Do you remember that guy, Brad Richdale, who was selling the TV course on making money now on television?
I don't.
He was all over TV. He was one of the early guys who learned all this direct marketing stuff, and he had a TV show, 30-minute show. And I remember I ordered that thing probably about 15 years ago off of TV, and then I got the tapes, and then you hear in the audience, you know, people going around the room, and there's Joe Polish. He goes, my name's Joe Polish at Piranha Marketing. You're going to hear about me. I mean, he had that passion many years ago, and he knew he was going to be there.
Yeah. One of the best things, Michael, of course, that we get to do, you and I, is we get that drink of this ocean of passion that happens at the top, and it's one of the rewards for moving up the ladder in success is the guys you get to hang out with. These are ethical guys brimming with integrity, and it's a joy to hang out with them, and it's just the ideas. I go to brainstorms. I'm about to go to another brainstorm in Vegas next week. I just got back from a Chicago brainstorm put on by Evan Pagan about 3 weeks ago. And in fact, it was at that brainstorm in Chicago. I was sitting at the bar with Mike Silsand, and Mike looks at me, and he's a top internet marketer. He looks at me and says, hey, can I give you a piece of advice? I said, yeah, of course. And he told me, he says, just do the launch, because I was resisting launching this product. I wanted to do it on a much lower scale. He says, just do it. He says, all of us are going to line up and want to do interviews with you and do this stuff. And he was one of my first webinar guys, and I was just astonished. I mean, I'm humbled by the fact that he credits me with a lot of the inspiration, the motivation, and the tactics and strategies he used to get where he's at. But he also shared some stuff he had never shared before. One of the central ideas to the guys in internet marketing, as opposed to a lot of the offline marketing stuff, but online, these guys are very aware of where they came from. Almost every single one of them, to a man, is a before and after story that will bring tears to your eyes. I'm talking about dead broke, you know, near suicide. And they made it. And one of the central tenets of their business philosophy is to give back. You know, the reason I became a guru really was I was a paste-up artist at a catalog in Silicon Valley back in the late 70s. And I met my first copywriter. And I had no idea that somebody was behind the words in this. And I was in the art department. It was my first time in a real art department, and I met this copywriter, and I thought, wow, this is great. This really sounds like something I could get into. And I asked her, how do you become a copywriter? She looked at me, she sighed and rolled her eyes. She said, it's way too hard. You'll never figure it out. So I sold her copy of John Caple's Method Advertising Methods and read enough of it before she stole it back that I realized I could do it, but I had to do it on my own. To this day, the reason I'm a teacher is that I made a vow then and there that if I made it, I would go back and help anybody else who wanted to make it too, and I would share everything I knew. That's been the outstanding element of my teaching style, which is I don't hold anything back. It's just I lay it out there. I can be a little harsh sometimes, but that's because money's on the line. You don't learn with pats on the back and nice try. You learn when it's hardcore stuff going on. So to this day, I remember her name. I won't say it because I don't want to be sued, but she motivated me negatively. And by the way, that was the answer to the question on the blog. If anyone wants to go back and look, almost all these guys had some negative motivation. Somebody told them no. You can't do it. You'll never be a success. You're a loser, or you'll never figure it out. And it's astonishing what the juice that that kind of motivation can give you. Every day you wake up and you're tired and you don't want to do it. You want to just go back to bed and you think, no, I'm going to prove it to so-and-so, and I'm going to go up and do it.
And these are the kinds of stories you got back from that challenge.
No, that was the answer to the question that I knew from hanging out with the top guys.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
About half a dozen of the people nailed it, got that. They had some version, and I gave them all the reward rather than just one guy. But a lot of people had a lot of different ideas about what the motivation was, and a lot of it was totally wrong. And it made me realize how important psychology, street-level salesmanship quality psychology, how important that is to understanding markets, to understanding selling, to understanding how to make a business work. I have a BA in psychology. You know that in 50 cents will get a cup of coffee, or $1.50 now at Starbucks. But the insights that I got from a lifetime of studying behavior psychology, you know, I've taken clients when I was living in San Diego, I'd take them to the zoo, and I'd have them watch the gorillas. And sometimes they'd ask me, why are we here watching the gorillas? I'd make them watch gorillas, and then they go, oh, I get it. And what they realize is that there are elements of how people treat each other in the way gorillas act. And you know, I take people to the mall, and I sit them down, and they watch people in the mall for half an hour, and they go, why are we here? And I think, this is your audience. This is your people. How are they behaving? You will die as a marketer if you think you're going to intuitively figure out what people do. People aren't hiding what they do. The best marketers are realists. They don't approach the market on how they wish it was or how they think the world ought to be. They approach the world on how it actually is. And this is where behavioral psychology comes in. We love this stuff. That's why we do so much research based on demographics and things like this. It's not what we wish. Most people, even political pundits and writers, you know, columnists in magazines and newspapers, operate almost entirely on the way they wish the world was or they think the world ought to be. And that's fine for opinion, but that doesn't affect how people actually act. And when you start getting into how people actually act, including what they buy, why they buy it, and how they go through the process in their head, then you start to understand things. Like Mark Twain's famous quote, there are two reasons why a man buys anything. One is the reason he'll tell you he bought it, and the other reason is the real reason he bought it. The most outlandish example of that is the guy having a midlife crisis and buying a Porsche. You know, he'll tell you, it's a great car, it's wonderful, I've always wanted one, blah, blah, blah. But there's a deeper psychological reason as to why he bought it. And the guy selling Porsches knows this. That's how they sell a lot of Porsches.
Here's a question from Rusty LaGrange of The Right Way Co., CO.com. He asked, I want to break into catalog copywriting to get some regular income while I'm developing my website as a freelance copywriter. Each business contact lead I look into for catalog work has either no freelance writers, no need for writers now, or such high educational standards listed that I just don't bother asking them for work. So my question is, John, what's the best way to find the production manager or creative director and get a foot in the door? If the websites hide all that info from the public, there are over 1,700 catalogs supposedly begging for copywriters. Just who are they?
This is a great question, and I'm going to beat Rusty up a little bit, but I do this out of love, not out of any kind of meanness. But Rusty, shame on you for letting the first obstacles you come across stop you. In creative writing, there are books that are put out by publishers about all of the agents and all of the publishers in New York and, in fact, all over the world. And all of the guys list their information. They either misspell their name or they get some other piece of incorrect information so that they can tell when somebody is contacting them through that kind of a phone book of everybody in New York publishing, for example, because they don't want to talk to people who have just pulled their name out of this book. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah, that's interesting.
And each business contact lead, I look into, you know, they tell me I don't have. That's the first answer. The first answer is always no. And when you're doing this, now, when I started my freelance career, I ran into this myself, and what I did was kind of sneaky, and I'm going to tell you a story that Rusty probably can't use, but this should be illustrative of the attitude you need. When I was down in Los Angeles, I started my freelance career with a typewriter, actually. This was before word processors. I had one tank full of gas left in my car, 1 month's rent left. I literally had no fallback position. I had to make this work. So I went to the direct response agencies in Los Angeles, and there happened to be a lot of them. And I was armed with very little information except that I had read a couple of books, and I'd been in advertising through the catalog in Silicon Valley, and I'd hung out, and I'd done a lot of research. I actually took a speed reading course and went to the Torrance Municipal Library and read everything in the Dewey Decimal System from 700 to 780, which is marketing, writing, salesmanship, business, all of this stuff. I did that thinking this was going to catch me up to everybody else, and in fact, it put me light years ahead of everybody else, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. I would go to the agencies, and I would try to set up an interview with the creative director, and often this was either going to be a five-minute little brush-up where I was going to rush in and rush out, and he was going to make his decision based on almost nothing. But what I would do is I would get in there, and I noticed something in the first agency I went into. There was a desk in the front room with phones ringing, manned by a single person, usually a young woman who was the receptionist. And I went up, and I always was very nice. The first day I had some gum, I offered her a piece of gum. I said, would you like a piece of gum? She goes, oh, yeah, my mouth's really dry. I said, would you like me to go get you a glass of water? She goes, well, that'd be great. I can't leave the desk. So I went and got her a glass of water. And I just chatted briefly. I didn't flirt with her. I just chatted. I treated her like a human being. Receptionists, most of these buildings, do not get treated like human beings. And I didn't have an agenda or a sneaky attitude. I'm that guy. But later I realized when I called back to kind of hassle the VP of marketing to say, hey, you know, have you got any work? I was going to call back. Remember, I'm the guy that came in last week. The receptionist put me through to the VP. She goes, oh, John, I remember you. Put me through to the VP while he was in another meeting that he wasn't supposed to be disturbed at. And at that point I thought, huh, I might be onto something here. And I actually worked the people. I didn't try to go straight to the VP. I actually started working the rest of the building. So when I actually got work at these agencies, and I eventually became the guy that got snuck in the back door to do all the work their staff writers couldn't pull off. And this is during my first year of freelancing. You know, I got to know the guys in accounting. I got to know the other writers on staff. I got to know the gossip, and I got to know all the stuff. And because I knew the guys in accounting, I would just stop by my way out, poke my head, and say, hey, Bob, what's going on? The boss says, hey, what are you doing here? I says, ah, I just finished a job. I think they're going to pay me. He would cut me a check right then before he got the invoice from the VP. So I realized there is some magic in it. What I developed is this attitude called sales detective work. And literally, you can put on your Sherlock Holmes style hat and get a pipe and sit down and think, what do I need to do to get past the barriers? I have this thing that I've written about in my newsletter before called There's Always a Way. And top marketers, they give me credit for it, but they talk about this a lot. They talk about there's always a way. No matter what obstacle you come across, there is always a way. And the way I illustrate this is I say, you can bet on one of two organizations. You can bet on the United States Coast Guard and military with their multi-trillion dollar budget, their helicopters, their radar, everything. Everything is safe out. You can bet on them, or you can bet on the Central American dope farmer with a 8-horsepower boat coming across. You can bet on which one is going to succeed. And of course, the answer is you bet on the Central American dope farmer, because he's going to find a way. He's going to look at this huge military complex, these helicopters, all this stuff, and he'll just find a way through. Now, there are better examples, of course. I don't want to get into politics of that, but it's the idea of the little guy looking at the big behemoth or the big corporation or whatever and thinking, oh my God, there's no way. How am I going to weasel my way into this catalog as a freelancer? You know, I'm a little guy. I don't have any contacts. I don't know anybody in this biz. Well, figure it out. You know, in Los Angeles, for example, I don't know where Rusty is, but in Los Angeles, there was something called the Creative Guild. I don't know if it's still there, but I found out about that early in my first year. I joined it. It was like $35. I joined. They'd have meetings every Thursday. And what it was a cocktail party with people from the agencies and stuff. And I went in there and I just started both making friends with some people and just talking. And I didn't sell myself. I did more of the bonding thing. And one of the things you realize is that people love to gossip and people love to share stories and they like to vent. So this detective work that I started developing for me just getting jobs, I used when I got a job. So I would start breaking things down. I would interview not just the top guy at a company I was going to write about, but I wanted to interview the feet in the street salesman. I wanted to interview the receptionist. I wanted to interview other people and things because I wanted to get the gossip and stuff the top guy isn't hearing about. You know, he has a certain idea of why people buy the product and how great his product is. The people who work for him have a much more realistic approach to this. They're the ones fielding the complaint phone calls. They're the ones handing out the refunds. They're the ones who are sitting there listening to people say, I wish this product did this, this, and this. That's the top guy that doesn't hear, doesn't want to hear, or it takes a long time to get up there. So when I was looking for work, you know, through this Creative Deal, I started meeting other writers. I was getting the inside shot, and I find out who was doing this stuff, and I was doing stuff. And when I started sending out letters to the various directors to be able to say, hey, I'm a freelancer and I need work, I applied all of the salesmanship skills I had to that. Plus, I did everything I could through my detective work to make sure that letter wound up in their hands, including sending them a FedEx package. And this was back when California had just started the lottery. So I would include three lottery tickets, and I would start out with something like, hi, Bob, this is John Carlton. I called you last week. I thought I'd just mail you this today because I'm about to make you a millionaire. And these guys talked about this later. I would go to direct marketing meetings with 4,000 people in the audience, and two guys would walk up and tell the story about John Carlton, who sent them this letter with the lottery tickets. I was astounded that other people hadn't tried this stuff, that people weren't doing this. So I got this name. And, of course, very soon after that, I met Gary Halbert and left the agency world. I was what's called an A-list writer. I started working for the biggest mailers in the world, Rodale, Phillips, Boardroom, within 3 or 4 years, and actually got an agent who started giving me jobs. And I left that world. I left millions to be able to go off with Halbert because I preferred the entrepreneurial side. It was just more fun working with these guys. I didn't have to put up with people stepping all over my stuff. Because no matter how good the copy I wrote for an agency was, two or three guys were going to step all over it before it saw the light of day, which means that I couldn't even say, I got these results in my writing because it wasn't my writing by the time it finished up. That really kicked me off.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Let me ask you this. When you were doing all your research, like in the library, and before you met Halbert, was there anyone other than like Claude Hopkins and, you know, all the classic guys, was there anyone relatively unknown that you really learned a lot from related to copywriting that most people would know about?
No. When I took that speed reading course, I didn't learn to speed read, by the way. I still read at a plodding scale, but the tactics that I took away from there was not to rely on any one book. There are two stages to this. One, you give yourself permission at any point when a book you're reading bores you, becomes irrelevant, or picks you off, or does anything, to close the book and throw it across the room, banging off two walls into the trash can. That freed me from the fact that I, like a lot of people, think that once you crack a book open, you are somehow committed to reading that book. And so books sit on your nightstand for 6 months or a year that you won't finish because you're bored with it. You know, throw it away. There's a lot of stuff out there. But the accompanying tactic is when you go to the library, you pull out 8 books at a time, put it on a stand, and go through them. And through speed reading, you learn to go through the table of contents, through the index page, you read all the chapter headings, you go in there and you start glancing around, and you actually go flip through almost every page of the book before you sit down to read it. And what you learn, even if you don't know anything about the subject, is after you're through the third or fourth book, certain names will start to pop out, certain concepts will start to pop out, and even without reading a single full paragraph, you can start to tell which books are good and which aren't. So you start segmenting them and pushing the other ones aside. And so when I was doing this at the library, what I came up with on my own was Claude Hopkins, Scientific Advertising, and My Life in Advertising, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, which is called The Salesman's Bible for a reason. A book called How I Made My First Million in Insurance by Frank Becker.
Frank Becker, yeah.
And all of the cable stuff. And through cables, I started reading Ogilvy, which help me. That was more of an inside in something. Ogilvy doesn't give you real tactics, but there's still great stuff. Top guys always quote Ogilvy. He's still a big hero of mine. Probably the one book that I would say at the time was unknown because it was part of Wilshire Publishing, which was a very small publishing house. And I found it by going out there because it was actually nearby where I lived. So I went to this publishing house and they had all these books out there. And there was this book by Victor Schwab called How to Write a Good Advertisement. And I picked it up and it was about 30 years old at the time. And I started spreading that around and other people found it too. I won't take credit for spreading, but that is typically one of those books that is now well known and people reference it a lot.
Yeah, I just interviewed Melvin Bowers about 2 months ago.
I didn't know he was still
alive. He's still alive.
God bless the guy. I picked up a couple of tips from him. One was rational emotive therapy, which was one of the things, precursor of NLP, that Melvin Bowers was publishing these guys when nobody else would publish them. And I just stumbled on that when I was out at the thing. I said, well, this looks interesting because, again, you know, I have a psych degree. So that was great stuff. Now, that kind of fell by the wayside. Went the way of transactional analysis. Remember, I'm okay, you're okay. You know, nobody knows about it now, but it was great stuff. But NLP just kind of swamped the rest of it.
I've heard the story of Gary Halbert talks about how he hooked up with Melvin. I think I mentioned that in an interview with Melvin. Gary Halbert wrote some copy for his Mail Order Millionaire course. Did you introduce Halbert to Melvin?
No, I think that was before I met Gary. I met Gary at Jay Abraham's divorce party in 1986, I believe. Gary had just started publishing. He'd just gotten out of the federal penitentiary, which is a story. His sixth newsletter was The Dark Side of Success.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all about that. But I met him right about his third or fourth newsletter, I think. He just got out. He was raring to go. I met him, and as I've written before, he was the most arrogant, dismissive, cocksure bastard that I'd ever met, and I liked him immediately.
Yeah.
And it became a great thing. So I was working with Gary from very, very long ago. He was my mentor, then he was my partner, and then after we quit working with each other, he remained my friend until the very end. So it's just a wealth of stuff going on. You know, but just to tie in with what Rusty was talking about, I met Halbert. This is all about recognizing opportunity. And one of the main books that formatted the way I did things was Think and Grow Rich. My before and after, and I talked about this in this guy, I'm not going to bore you on the phone here, but my before and after is as bad as anybody. I mean, when I discovered Think and Grow Rich, I had just lost my job, my girlfriend, and my place to live all within a month. I was literally living in my car, looking up every friend I had on the West Coast who had a couch to sleep on and sleeping on it, and was really unrooted and thinking, what am I going to do now? And what's going on? I mean, I wasn't exactly destitute, but I was just in a bad place. And it never occurred to me, because this isn't the way I grew up. I grew up in a working class house in a small town in Southern California. It had never occurred to me, and nobody told me, because nobody knew among the people I grew up with, that you could actually have a goal and make a plan and go after it. You could say, I want to X. I want to own this. I want to make this much money. I want to meet this person. I want to have this kind of life, and then make a plan and go after it. That, to me, was literally one of those, you know, St. Paul falling off his horse moments, you know, where just this blinding light of realization happened to me. And I became this guy who started making goals. And, of course, anybody who starts making goals realizes there's a process you have to go through, because a lot of times the first goals you think you want, when you get them, you don't really want them, but you start to refine the process. And everything I do is all based on this goal-setting stuff that I learned in Think and Grow Rich. So that was one of the fundamental books of that, and Dale Carnegie and John Caple's Tested Advertising Method, along with Claude Hopkins.
Where did you grow up? Did you live in San Diego for a while?
I did, but I grew up in Cucamonga. It's now called Rancho Cucamonga. They changed the name, but incorporated Etowanda and Guaski. It was one of the oldest parts of Southern California. I grew up a block from Route 66, and that part of Route 66 had been the Spanish Trail in the 1700s and 1800s and stuff. So it was a very old part of California. I grew up among vineyards and orchards and things. All of these are gone now, of course, but I grew up in a very bucolic, not exactly backward, but kind of like American Graffiti type town, because Frank Zappa's dad taught at my high school. There was a lot of energy there, and a lot of people that came from my little tiny high school have gone on to great things. It's kind of stunning. There must have been something in the water there. But it was very much a small town atmosphere and very much lost, very much totally unprepared for the real world.
How long did you live in San Diego for?
I lived in San Diego for 6 months. I don't want to go deep into this, but when I was living out of my car, somehow my old high school friend got a hold of me through, he called somebody to call somebody else, and he called me because he'd just gotten divorced, and he had just gotten a job as the city attorney for one of the cities around San Diego. I think it was National City. And somehow he got a hold of me and said, John, I'm divorced. I'm living in a house down here. You know, why don't you come stay with me? Somehow he found out I was in dire straits. So I went down, and it was in San Diego, and I wound up staying there in 6 months, and that's where all this stuff started coming together. I answered my first direct response ad in a newspaper. I was hanging down in San Diego at this house, sleeping on the floor with my typewriter, you know, thinking I was going to be the next Jack Kerouac. And I picked up the LA Times, I think, or maybe it was the San Diego Tribune, and there was an ad there for The Lazy Man's Way to Riches. And that was the first ad that caught me at the perfect time. I was the perfect prospect, and I got that. Of course, that was my intro to Think and Grow Rich. That was kind of a translation of the goal setting thing. And so that got me involved in that, and I still have that newspaper. I don't have the ad because I literally cut out the coupons, mailed it in with like $10 or $9 or whatever, got the book, and I still have the newspaper, and it set me off on this path that led me to kind of getting my life together, to decide I could become a freelance. I actually worked for a small company for a while as a staff writer, just to kind of work my chops a little bit, make sure that I had my skills down, and just kept progressing. And then when I was able to meet Jay Abraham, that was through a small opportunity that I would have missed if I hadn't been absolutely laser focused on any possible opportunity coming my way that I could jump on. So I jumped on it, got moving, and met Jay Abraham, and he wouldn't have otherwise paid any attention to me, but we had in common the Claude Hopkins reading, because that was a book that was out of print at the time. We both read it, he started paying attention, and I traded writing for free run of his office. I started meeting people in the office. I knew that opportunity was there. I wasn't making a dime, but I was getting a $1 million education just hanging out there.
Great story. Okay, let's go on to Alan Silverstein of Forever Green Marketing, LLC. John, I'd like to know how true it is that direct response mail outperforms email, and by how much?
Let me answer that. Whenever I speak at a seminar, well, most of the times I speak, if I have a minute, I will pause in the room, no matter how big the room is, and I speak in front of hundreds and hundreds and up to, you know, thousand people, and I will ask, is there anybody in here? Because most of this crowd will be an internet crowd, usually now. The marketing things are full of the web-oriented marketing. And I will say, is anybody here doing offline marketing, sending out direct mail? And there's usually four or five guys in the back of the room who will reluctantly and meekly raise their hands. And I will look in the back of the room and say, okay, I'll just pick one up. What's it done for your bottom line? And they will pause, they'll look at each other, and they'll mumble. And I said, what? I can't hear it. They'll say, it doubled response. And those guys are in the back of the room, not because they're slackers, but because they are so hip that they're there to hear me. They're there to pick up all the info they can, and they don't care about being up front. They don't dress well. They don't call attention to themselves. These are hardcore marketers. So my problem back in the early 2000s was trying to get my offline clients online. They were reluctant to go online. Nobody's going to use a credit card to buy anything online. I mean, it's amazing now, these few years later, how much the world has changed. My 86-year-old father gets his medications from New Zealand online, you know, using a credit card and mail. So that's just astounding to me. So my big problem was getting people who were all offline online. Now my problem is getting people who are all online to at least experiment with offline stuff.
Okay, he also asked, using space advertising for developing sales leads, what size space ad and where in the newspaper, I guess positioning or magazine, should you have it displayed?
Well, this is all old school stuff. Gary Halbert's newsletter, thegaryhalbertletter.com, is still up. I'm dealing with his sons now, trying to make that site as viable as possible, so there'll be other things being done there. But he talks about that. That's old school direct response, which there's a lot of wisdom in the old guys talking about this, and Gary, of course, has talked about that a lot. But the answer is, it depends. Anywhere from a business card size to a full page. It's a numbers game. And this is what any top veteran is going to tell you. It's a numbers game. Here's the main question, Alan. What is a lead worth to you? If it's worth a lot, you know, there are people that will pay $500 for a lead. There are people that will pay $5,000 for a lead. If you're selling yachts and you're going to pay $5,000 for a guy who's ready to buy a yacht, is it worth $5,000? Well, yeah. But a lot of people focus on those. I want to get the leads as cheaply as possible, you know, because I got more hands. Okay, but online, I do not have the largest list online. I do not have even a middling size list. I have what is considered a modest size list of people. Yet I consistently outpull in response other marketers who have lists 5 to 10 times my size because it's quality over quantity. But these other guys have big lists because they've been doing this off and they want more. They just know that the more names I have, the more the numbers are going to go up. And it's not so much quality, it is quantity. And that's a legitimate marketing decision to make. So what's the lead worth to you? If you're only willing to pay a nickel for a lead because in your experience that's all it's worth because you got to get 400 leads to make one sale and you're selling something for, you know what, $39, then, well, first, that's a bad marketing model. But if that's the game, then taking out a full-page newspaper or magazine ad would be marketing suicide because you're going to pay at minimum $10 to $100 a lead there, depending on the magazine. If you do a little business card size thing and you throw it in the classified ads or things like that, you're going to get 5-10 leads or, you know, it could depend. And, you know, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's all you need. But for most people, it's just you sit down and you figure out, how many leads do I have? What's the lead worth to me? What's my most efficient manner of bringing those leads in? Then you're going to have to test. Some people will do full-page ads in newspapers for lead generation, not for selling. That, you know, that runs counter to a lot of guys' gut instincts, but they will do it. Other guys just find something that works, so they'll be in there. As far as placement, that all depends, too, because you're going to pay more for the excellent placement, which is what, the third page or the last page in the sports section or the first page following the lifestyle section. Or there's always little games you can play, but you're going to pay more for the best position. And when you do anything less than a full-page ad, you don't get to choose position. So that's a whole other game.
All comes down to mathematics.
All comes down to math, yes.
All right, here's a question from Alex Marabou of MakeMoneyOnlineForNewbies.org. And he says, John, what do you suggest in order to get targeted traffic as far as writing or copywriting is concerned? Articles, ads, banners, pay-per-click, etc.
This is one of those easy ones. Use them all. Now, when he says, as far as writing or copywriting, I'm assuming that he's talking about getting clients. Pay-per-click seems to be working the best. But the banners and the articles, certainly, that's a PR game. So that's part of getting your name out there. If you introduce yourself as, hi, I'm Alex Marabou and I'm a copywriter, well, yeah, okay, that's great, Alex. But if you say, hi, I'm Alex Marabou, I'm the author of blah, 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 or I'm the guy that wrote those 5 articles for DMNews.com that started the controversy and got all the response, blah, blah, or I'm Alex Marabou, the guy who was just on Larry King talking about it, then that's a different way of positioning yourself. So it's all about positioning, and you don't do that magically. You don't do that by just saying you're the best. You know, I'm Alex Marabou, I'm the best damn copywriter in the universe. So are you now? But I'm Alex Marabou, the guy who's been writing for Boardroom for 5 years. I've got 6 controls right now. It's a whole different position.
Let me ask you this. What was your first real success in the copywriting field? You were working in that office. You were doing smaller work. When was your, I guess, most memorable, very first success? For more information, go to johncarltonoffer.com. That's johncarltonoffer.com.
My first job, I went to this agency in Los Angeles. I was nervous. I went in somehow. I apologize. I can't tell you how I got this. I was literally looking at the Los Angeles Times One ad, and there was a section for writers or copywriters or advertising agencies, and the agencies down there were hungry for freelancers. I think they still do it today, but back then they would say, writer wanted, you know, portfolio needed, blah, blah, blah. And I think I was just going in for an interview. I went in and I pressed the guy enough to get this job, and what he gave me was an insurance job. It was a one-page letter selling insurance. They still do these kind of mailings. It was just one page, you know, hey, you should have this, I think it was life insurance or something. And that's all they needed. And they had tried it 5 times, and the client had turned out have 5 manuscripts. So they burn through everybody on their staff. So this VP of creative is going to try a freelancer for the first time. And I come in, and, you know, I'm doing my best to be confident, be that go-to guy, and toss around stuff. He goes, here's the letter that the latest one they just turned in. He says, can you beat this? Can you give us a letter the client will like? I just glanced at it. I said, yeah, sure. You know, because I didn't know. But I knew that I was going to work as hard as possible, and I had those resources of the John Gables and all that stuff. He says, okay. He says, how long do you need? And I paused, and I thought, I'd never been asked this question. So this was 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday. I paused, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I can stay up. I said, how about 10 o'clock tomorrow morning? And his eyes got really wide, and he just said, okay. And I'm sure he was taking it back and said, this guy's a nutcase. I went back, stayed up all night, wrote the thing. It wasn't hard. It was a pretty basic, straightforward letter. Brought it back at 10 a.m. The guy was astonished to see me there at 10 a.m. And by Monday afternoon, he was on the phone, and he's saying the client loved it. It's the first one he did. We're going to run with it.
What'd you make on that?
Back then, I made what was standard for a freelancer, which was $2,000.
Wow, that's pretty good.
So back in the 80s, that's probably 10 grand right now, right?
Wow, for a one-page letter.
Well, also overnight. So what happened, Michael, was I got tagged as the guy who turned it around overnight. Now, he told me, he says, John, he says, I wasn't going to tell you before. I was willing to give you 2 weeks on this. He says, next time I give you a job, I'm going to insist you take the 2 weeks, because if you did this well in one night, you know, it's going to get better. Because I would have just gone off to the next job and done it overnight, too, and stayed up all night, which I actually did. But I became known as the guy who could turn this stuff around really fast. That moved my name up from the bottom of the freelance list to the very top of the freelance list.
Very quickly?
Yes. I can't tell you what the results were. I will tell you that I got into an argument then. He put me in a room with the designer who had already designed the direct mail piece going out. And she says, well, first thing we got to do is cut half of this copy, because there's not enough room in it. He signed for all the copy. And I just put down my pen. I said, you got to bring the VT back in, because we're not cutting a word. And she goes, what do you mean? And she thought she was going to bully me. She was this very experienced graphic artist. And I've had run-ins with graphic artists all the time, because they like to consider copy these gray floating blocks of a design element. You know, they don't understand it's all about the copy. And design is totally secondary. They don't like hearing that. And especially back then, there was a raging argument about design. Long copy was long dead back then. And I was doing semi-long copy books, certainly pushing for longer and longer copy, and run-ins with graphic artists. I won that argument. That graphic artist hated me for the rest of her career and would trash me until I started sending work away. And I just did that. I did the right thing. I sent her some work, and so she stopped trashing me. But, you know, she never went very far because she thought copywriters should be subservient to the design, which, of course, was wrong. So I learned a lot in that first job. And so regardless of the results, they mailed third class. I don't know if you can keep track of results, but the client loved it. They wanted more. I kept the account for that agency. The agency started giving me more and more work. They spread my name around. All kinds of things happened there, all because I was open to opportunity and stood by my guns and did a really stupid thing, which was stay up all night writing copy.
And that's another good solution to getting work is come up with a winner, and your client will want you back for more.
Exactly. You know, a lot of times it is just that first, getting back to Mr. LaGrange, who was trying to break in. You know, don't think about it as conquering the whole industry. Think about getting that first job, doing well in that first job, and then the rest is easy. It's like you're outside the wall, and you're looking in the window, and you're thinking, how do I get in? And somebody comes along and opens the door for you and lets you in, even a step, you're in. Now that's over with. Now it's how you perform as you're inside the wall. You are no longer outside looking in. You are inside. Now your next task is to figure out how to stay inside and how to make it work to your best advantage. But it can seem like the biggest and only problem you have is getting inside. It's really not. That's a solvable problem that once you do get it solved, it no longer is even on your radar.
All right, that's great. Elliot Gordon asked, hello, Mr. Carlton, and thanks for taking the time to be here. I'm about to take my first step into marketing consulting, and I was wondering, how safe is it to enter into the business at this time? With the economy in shambles and rumors of a coming 1930s-style depression or worse, how would you approach selling your copywriting and marketing consulting services to small business owners?
I've been doing a lot of interviews. You heard at the beginning I talked about Thelman, Knudsen, and the worst. And the typical response, and I got this from Gary Halbert, and I used to say this all the time, and you know, we talk about how to prosper in a rotten economy and things like that. And the real answer is that the first thing you should do when you're up against a bad economy is give up. Cash in all your stuff, liquidate all your holdings, and go up and find a nice cave and go in there and curl into a fetal position until the storm blows over. So that's the advice we give people. If you take that, then fine, you're that guy. It's a rare person who just looks and says, okay, you know, it's like you're that guy in the boat, again, going back to the farmer working his way through the American industrial complex, you know, his defense. You just got to find a way. And none of the top marketers I know are spending a second worrying about the economy. Not a second. Now, they may adjust a few things here and there. They certainly don't pretend it's not happening. But, you know, the Dow is a roller coaster. But the Dow is, what, 30 companies or 50 companies? I mean, it's not the whole thing. And, in fact, depending on what market you're in, there's always markets that rise up. In the 1930s, you know, entertainment, movies, we're doing bang-up businesses. The economy doesn't collapse. One of the first pieces of advice I might give is to stop reading newspapers. If you are taking what you're reading and holding it in your gut and you're getting worried and upset and all this stuff's happening, just stop it. Just don't read the paper anymore. You go 3 months until you can kind of cleanse yourself of the gloom and doom. And don't read stuff online and don't follow that. Because, you know, humans follow grief like rats after cheese. We are grief magnets. We love it. That's why daytime television is the way it is. That's why talk shows are the way it is. That's why talk radio is the way it is. You know, we love grief. And a lot of that is a lot of people out there want to hear that they have an excuse not to succeed. And this ties in with one of the reasons you're going to have if you step forward and be that guy who's going to say, okay, I'll become an entrepreneur and I'm going to do it, because you're going to run into a lot of obstacles just in the business side. But the biggest obstacles you're going to run into is that you're going to have zero fan club. Your neighbor is going to secretly hope that you fail. Your brother-in-law, the cocky guy with all the opinions, is going to take great delight in every failure you have. Your spouse may even think, I'm going to leave this guy because he's not going to make it. There's no way you're going to. You are not going to have a fan club. So you've got to overcome a lot of obstacles as you go, not just the economy, but everything. So you're going to have a lot of excuses to quit. the guys who succeed just look at those excuses, and there's no such thing as a problem that stops you. There's always a way. A problem is merely a new lesson to be learned, or, you know, failure is a new lesson to be learned. A problem is merely a new challenge to get by, things like that. And the entrepreneurs that make it work, they love this stuff. I mean, it's just, okay, you know, this is something new. You know, this keeps it exciting. What's that Chinese curse, Michael? May you live in interesting times. Well, we certainly live in interesting times. And as you encountered these things, there was a point I was going to make. Let's see, he's talking about the economy, and I was bringing up people wanting you to fail. Kind of lost track of that.
So he says, how would you approach selling your copy and marketing consulting services?
Yeah, okay, it depends. What do you offer that is proven, unique, and gets results? I mean, it's that thing of standing up, and people are reluctant to brag. Somehow they want marketing to happen by magic or voodoo or something. But really, you've got to inform him and use salesmanship to say, look, here's what I've got, and this really will help you. Here's how it will work. My basic pitch is, you know, here's who I am, here's what I got, here's how it's going to help you, here's what you need to do now. And that little litany has changed a lot of people's lives when they're marketing. They think, oh, I get it. You know, you can tell stories, you can do all this clever stuff, but cleverness pales in comparison to the most basic salesmanship there is. Here's what I got, here's who I am, here's why you should trust me. And that's where testimonials come in and third-party validation and all that stuff. Here's what I've got, here's what's going to do for you. That's what the benefit thing. I think there's a question here about benefits coming up. And here's what you need to do now. That's the forceful stepping forward and saying, look, I'm the guy you really should deal with. I have all these resources, blah, blah, blah. You can go try the other guys first if you want, because you're going to wind up coming back to me anyway. Here's what's going to cost. Total guarantee. You are under no risk at all to deal with me. You can try this stuff out, give it a test drive, do all this stuff, blah, 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 blah. You take all the risk, put it on your shoulders, not on your prospect's shoulders, and develop a salesmanship pipeline that conquers all the objections he has, overcomes all the problems he has, and makes the next most logical step and emotionally satisfying step to be him just saying, okay, I'll give it a try.
Okay, great. Here's a question from Volker Ritzka of www.flycam1.com.au. He asks, living in Australia, I see copywriting that mainly goes like this. Buy now. Don't miss out. These won't last long. Buy at bargain prices. Only a stock lasts, etc. Many of the ads sales copy have plenty of these catchy phrases, but no or little product description. Every time I see them, I wonder if I'm wrong for never using those phrases. I'll try to not be pushy to the customer. Is there a use in using those buy now phrases? Recommended to use often, seldom, or never.
Okay, I've actually been talking about this during this entire call. It's all about salesmanship. Salesmanship is so misunderstood that other marketers would wish I would stop trying to make it better understood, because this is the ace in the hole, the secret weapon top marketers have. All of the competition misunderstands salesmanship. They think hype is bad and aggressive selling is horrible, and anybody that tries to sell forcefully is no better than a used car salesman, and they do all this stuff. And this is the big problem that a lot of marketers have. They think my customers are different. They don't respond to hype and they don't blah, blah, blah. It's all nonsense. Hype is offensive. It's offensive to me. It's offensive to you. It's offensive to everybody. Until you need what's being hyped. Then it's just good, solid info. What I mean by that is you have this buy now, don't miss out. If I need carpenter nails, and I need a whole bunch of them right now, and I hear somebody shouting or something catches my eye that says carpenter nails on sale for half price, one day only, come in and buy now. If I'm not in the market for carpenter nails, then I'm kind of like, what the heck is that? That means nothing to me. If I'm in the market for that, that is the best thing I could have seen today. And again, back to that shame on you if you don't do everything in your power. We don't tell people to shout. And again, I don't like hype, and I don't use hype. There was a time when I used the exclamation mark a bit in my copy. I don't use it at all now. I will use bold and bold italic, and I'll do yellow highlighting, you know, even online in my copy occasionally. But I also just do straight ahead stuff. I let the words do the selling. The people that respond negatively to anything you say, if you say, you really do need this, you need it now, you need to act right now, it's only going to be here for a very short period of time, there are limited supplies, if you miss out, you're probably never going to see it again. All that stuff is meant to overcome the natural human inclination to not move in your own best interest. Having one human being take money that was his out of his wallet and give it to you, that kind of metaphor, is one of the hardest human transactions to have happen. Regardless of how much you do it during the day, it's still hard to get somebody to do it for the first time with you. Hard to get people to come into your restaurant. Hard to get them to buy whatever it is you're selling, no matter how good it is, no matter how much it will help them. It's hard to get them to do that. That's why salesmanship is the way it is. It has to be psychologically pleasing, effective. There is a bit of bludgeoning going on. It doesn't have to be the used car sales and stuff. Even the most smooth letter that you've read, either online or in the mail or in an ad, where it just glides, where you think, wow, that was great. I'm really glad I found that, is applying salesmanship. Sometimes they'll raise the voice. If you're in a crowded place, you might need to raise your voice. But if you're not, there's times where raising your voice makes you a loon or a lout, and that's not what you want to be. So you can whisper the same words. If the guy can hear you when you're whispering. And I call this a nudge to the ribs kind of advertising. It's like, hey, I've got these carpenter nails for sale at half price. I've not let it known to everybody, but if you need them, do I need them? I was looking for them right now. My God, this is the best thing I could have heard. And that's what your advertising has to be. You want to be that one thing he reads today that makes his day, that makes him sit up, that makes him light up, that makes him think, wow, this is great. This is the best thing I've ever come across. And it can really be if you're looking for a radio or something, you're thinking, well, I guess I got to go to Radio Shack or I got to go to somewhere and get a radio because I'm going off where I'm going to need to carry a radio when I'm going on vacation or something. And you're thinking, I guess at some point I'm going to have to take the time. And you see something, Radio Shack is having a sale right now on those radios, and they're half price, and it's one day only, blah, blah, blah. That's the best thing you could have seen today. So rather than sometime, you know, eventually you'll sort of get around to maybe looking for radio, you're going to hop in the car and go over there right now. That's how this stuff works. Salesmanship is the way it is because it works. It hasn't much changed since the first caveman traded his cave for a better cave with a view or a slab of mastodon beef. There's a little bit of salesmanship going on. We have some written records from ancient Rome with used chariot salesmen. This just cracks me up. And, you know, the stuff that they've used is the same stuff that you're seeing now. Censorship hasn't changed since the dawn of language.
Perfect. Michael Campbell of SuperhumanSecrets.com asks, what's the fastest way to identify the psychological hot buttons in a particular market, the real motivators that prize them off the sofa and into action? And I know we could talk for an hour, but give maybe one or two of the fastest and most important.
There's three answers. One is know the market, which would be if you're selling HO trains to people, be an HO train enthusiast. Then that passion naturally comes across. Or if you don't know the market, get involved. Get on every single HO train newsletter list there is. Get online, start Googling them. Go hang out at a convention. Go hang out at a hobby shop. Get to know them. And third was one of the first answers we talked about. Ask. Ask people face-to-face. Start ask campaigns. Get involved. Do your due diligence in your research. It doesn't have to be onerous. It doesn't have to be a big hassle. It can be really easy. A savvy salesman who knows nothing about HO trains can pop in the car, go downtown, go into a hobby shop, and hang out at the HO train section of the hobby shop. Talk to three people and figure it out.
Okay, Alvin of The Book Tribe asks, some products seem silly and useless at first, but upon launch, people just snatch them up like there's no tomorrow. On the other hand, there are brilliant products that seem like guaranteed blockbusters, but the market just hates them no matter how they are positioned. As an experienced marketer, what are your criteria in determining which products or projects are worth spending time on?
This was the question, Michael, that I referenced earlier about quality versus magic. To answer, Alvin, you just have to figure it out. I, too, grieve over the same issue because what I offer is huge substance, literally mentoring, the actual step-by-step process. I can't sell what I sell as far as, you know, learning how to write and learning how to market stuff without having a little bit of work involved. I can't compete with somebody who says it's magic. You know, get this book, put it under your pillow, and you wake up tomorrow as a marketing wizard. So substance will always lose out to magic. It's kind of like back in high school, the flashy jock who will soon be pumping gas kiss the homecoming queen. Adult life is really just third grade recess and high school all over again. You know, that's why I took guys to the San Diego Zoo to watch the gorillas. It's like we're not really that much. You will recognize people you know in the gorilla area of the San Diego Zoo. I hate to keep saying, but it does come down to figure it out. I had a very successful launch selling essentially work and some hard stuff in a bad market, you know, against all the stuff. It was hard. And other people have done launches selling essentially the same benefits that I had. They touted their stuff the same, but it was crap. It was nonsense. These guys, you know, shouldn't be teaching, and what they did was find a way to kind of shortcut it, and they offered magic. And there's no way I'm going to compete with that, and I don't want to. This is off the subject, but if one of the ways you decide you've won in business is the amount of money that you make, great. People come to me and they say, I need to make a lot of money in a very short period of time. I don't want to work, and I don't want to learn anything, and I don't want to blah, blah. I say, fine, go rob a bank. You know, you'll have a lot of money, but there's going to be a lot of consequence too to this. So it's kind of like if you want to get into marketing, get into the diet market and start making claims that you'll make a lot of money, but you'll probably go to jail within the year. You know, it's like, how do you define how you win? And I have never been motivated by money. I do not define how I win by money. I have a great life. I feel really good about what I offer. I offer substance and quality. I love teaching. I love writing. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. For me to be in a position to look back on my 25-year career and take the stuff that I learned, you know, I took notes the whole way. That's what makes me different, you know, teacher than everybody else. I took notes. I went through this stuff. I was on the front line the entire time, and I made every mistake possible, and I came from nothing, so I can identify with everybody. And I just feel really good about this. I couldn't care less. I mean, my goals are much more modest than the guys who want to buy their own island in the Caribbean and cavort with the wealthy. So I've hung out with the wealthiest people in the world. I've hung out with CEOs. I've hung out with people of enormous influence and power. You know what? They're some of those boring people on the planet. I will sacrifice a huge chunk of wealth to keep my life interesting. I tell a story. This is a great story. I call it the 39th Auto Supply Store, and it's very brief. It was a Gary Halbert seminar that I was co-producing, and it was over. It had been a hardcore hot seat seminar. Don't remember the name of it, but it was down in Miami Beach. So we're sitting around, Gary and I and a few of the teachers, and a few of the attendees were sitting around at a table on Ocean Boulevard, having a drink, relaxing, telling more stories and laughing, and watching as the sun was setting behind us, the waves were lapping up, a gentle tropical warm breeze was ruffling the palm trees, and beautiful people were walking by, girls in bikinis. It was just a wonderful, great thing. And the guy next to me, all he could talk about was opening up his 39th auto supply store.
Yeah.
I turned to him and I said, stop. You're either going to leave or you're going to shut up. And I actually found out about him. He had a wife who hated him, kids he was estranged from. He was 100 pounds overweight. He was miserable, and he was so focused on life. And he was wealthy beyond the dreams of avarice. What was that wealth doing for him? Absolutely nothing. And that's a lesson that I took to heart, have always kept close to my heart, and gone for quality. So, you know, I could make a lot more money by reducing the substance. I mean, this sounds odd, but it's really true. By reducing the substance, I could make a lot more money because I could get closer to offering magic. I just can't do it. I won't do it, and it's not worth it.
Let me ask you, with Calvin's question, the one thing that came to my mind was Halbert's hamburger stand story. Would you tell that story for him? Because understanding that hungry market is really critical, too.
Sure. Halbert's hamburger story is one of his first year's newsletters. He told this story, and he called it the starving crowd. And what it was he says, I will give you any advantage you want in a market, and I will beat you by choosing the one thing that I want. He says, you can choose whatever you want. And he says, when he asked people that question, experienced veteran marketers, they would typically say, I want a better quality product. I want the lowest price. I want to be positioned, or I want this or that. I want a big ad budget. They give all these answers. He says, fine, you can have all of that. Not just one thing, but you can have all of that. He says, all I want is a starving crowd. He says, I will sell the worst hamburger for the highest price, and I won't have a clean establishment. We'll be rude. We'll will be everything. And all I want is that I'm the only place to get food with a starving crowd. And that was it. And that's the point he made. So the overall point is that the advantage that you really want is to find a market that is hungry and you offer what they want. That's where the ask campaigns come in. You know, you can go into the most crowded market with thousands and thousands of competitors who are better funded than you. They've been in the business longer. They're smarter. They got big staff. And if you find a hole in what they're offering, it could be as simple as customer service. You say, I'm not a big company. I'm one guy working out of this house. But I'll tell you what, when you call my office, I'm the guy that picks up the phone. You know, that kind of angle. That may be exactly what's missing out there. That's how a lot of companies have come up. You know, I bought 3 or 4 computers from Gateway back when they were first coming out because it was one of the best places to get a computer through the mail, to get it done. The customer service was top. You could actually buy extra better customer service. And I actually knew the lawyer for Gateway. He lived in Sioux City, South Dakota. And over the course of a year, they just got worse and worse. For whatever reason, they stopped paying attention to customer service because it was so expensive. And bean counters, as happens, rose in the executive ranks, and they started cutting customer service. Finally, they got to the point where everybody I knew had a Gateway computer that didn't work, and they couldn't get anybody on the phone. And this happened in a very short period of time, and that's when Dell came in. And Dell's big thing was what?
Service.
Customer service.
All right, good story. Jess Hunt, he's an HMA marketing consultant in the UK. He asked, John, I have a marketing consultancy business, and I'm studying copywriting to have a better understanding of the process and how I can use it to get clients, as well as to be able to use techniques and strategies more effectively with clients. But has John written for the UK market before? And if he did, what differences did he find in his approach and the response he got? If he hasn't, then what would his approach be to a more skeptical, reserved market?
This ties in with something I said before. He thinks people in the UK are different than people in the United States. I will grant you that the UK is behind the United States in that all of Europe is relatively right around the late 70s as far as direct response savvy, meaning that before the EU, before the European Union, there was not a coherent mail service. So getting a letter from Italy to France was a problem. Now it's not. There was problems with the money. Now that they're on the euro instead of, you know, all these different currencies, it's not a problem. The UK kicked in faster than the rest of Europe for various reasons. I was in Italy 2 years ago and saw my first info commercial, and it's an American guy there doing his thing in English, and he had this gorgeous Italian model who would translate everything he said. Now, she didn't exactly translate it with all the enthusiasm, so you saw this guy jumping around like a loon, speaking a language he didn't understand, which would be English, and then this gorgeous Italian model would translate it for him in a very calm, centered voice, but you got the idea. And the answer is that Jez Hunt thinks the UK is different because they're more skeptical and reserved. And I will tell you, A, I have written for Europe. I have a lot of students over in England and the UK, and they are not more skeptical, and they are not more reserved, and they are not different. There is none, zero, zip difference between going to the UK market than the United States market, or anywhere else in Europe, or anywhere else in the world. I will explain that in a second. Except for the slang. Except for how you describe things. He spelled skeptical in this with a C, S-C-E-P. You know, there are differences you need. But you can also say, hey, I'm an American, and I'm going to misspell some of this stuff. I don't spell labor with a U, but here's what I've got, blah, blah. And if what you have is important enough, they will overlook that stuff, and they will get by. And in fact, we used to tell a story from Albert and I about New Yorkers. If you've ever hung out with New York City dwellers, they think they are impervious to hype. You can't scoot anything over on them. They've heard it all. They've done it all. They've seen it all. A good salesman wants to come up against a prospect like that. He's more skeptical. He's more reluctant. You can't fool him. Because that salesman is going to pause. He's going to come in the side door. He's going to make the fastest sale of his life. Because when you got somebody who's so-called skeptical, reluctant, and he's all, you know, you can't sell me. You know, nah, there's no way this can be true, blah, blah, blah. You just sneak in the side door. And you come in there and you say, I don't think this product is for you. You know, classic takeaway. Probably not for you, but you may be interested in it because for the guys who have gotten it, they've actually, blah, 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 you know, grown hair where they used to be bald, if you talk to a bald guy. And you don't say, you should get this because if you're bald, this will grow hair on your head. You say, this probably isn't for you. You're way too savvy for this. This probably won't work, I think, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway because I'm that guy who just loves to fail because I learn a lesson. But here it goes. I got this stuff again. You know, this is, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you go into this takeaway and you slip in the side door and you'll make the fastest sales of your life. And the guys who are doing this in the UK, the UK copywriters who learned from me are going out there making a mint. I will tell you one other story. One guy in Japan took all of my stuff from Kick-Ass Copywriting Secrets, translated it, took a lot of my old ads, translated them into Japanese, and modified them for other markets, and was making $1 million a month. People have been ripping my stuff. They stalked my ads for years. That's why I decided to become a teacher, was there was no other way for me to make money off my old ads, because people would find them and modify them. So they take a golf ad and modify it for the chiropractic coaching field. I mean, basic salesmanship is basic salesmanship. He didn't do anything unethical. He was a big fan. But I actually got in front of that, people ripping my ads. I gave a seminar called License to Steal. Taught people how to rip my ads because a lot of them were doing it wrong. So I just said, here's 5 of my top ads. Here's how to rip them. Look, here's what I'm doing in the headlines, and I explained. That's one of my better selling seminars.
Do you sell that still?
Yeah, it's on DVD. I would highly recommend that anybody who wants to get involved really deal with Michael's connection with me. He has access to me. He's not going to give it out, but he's one of the privileged guys who has direct access to me. When I say privileged, I don't mean that I'm purposely hard to get. Is that just because there's so many people trying to get a hold of me, I have to limit it? I'm hard to get a hold of. I'm impossible to hire. I haven't taken on a new client in a couple of years. I'm mostly teaching. I'm doing this stuff. So the best way to get mentoring and stuff is to do what Michael is going to help you.
Anyone who wants to see all the things John offers on his main site other than the blog can go to www.johncarltonoffer.com. And that will take you to John's site. And John, on that site, how is that different from the blog?
Well, I have many sites online, and the site that you're sending them to is kind of the most basic site where I offer, you know, a way into what I have to offer, I guess. It's a way to get that famous book, Kick-Ass Copyright Secrets of a Marketing Rebel. I'm so proud that it is on many of the top marketers' desks, very much thumbed through, very dog-eared. It's still used. It's a one-stop resource for a lot of things, maybe the only thing you actually need to kick your marketing off. And it's just a good example. If you want to see a piece of writing by me, you will actually see some writing there, and you will have an opportunity to see what other people have to say about me and kind of get a feeling for what's going on, and you'll have an opportunity to get involved if you want.
Very good. John, I appreciate it. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground, even though we only covered 2 pages of about 8 pages of questions. Let me make a tentative offer to any of the listeners, and John, if it's okay and if it happens, when your schedule lets up next year, if we're able to continue on and do another interview, anyone who goes on to johncarltonoffer.com and signs up on John's site, when we get the second interview done, if we do it, he'll provide you the part two of this unfinished interview. Is that fair?
Oh, that's very fair. And it's a pleasure talking with you. I'm really delighted with the quality of the questions, and I went off on a couple of tangents, but that's what's fun about this. There's so much to know. There's so much to learn, and it's fun for me to even go through some of the old stories. I know from many years of teaching that this way of teaching, of relating anecdotes, of making sure that you understand this is stuff that's happened to me or happened to people that I know, and it's usable stuff. It kind of explains what's going on. This is the best kind of teaching that I've learned from myself, and it's the best way I've been able to get my point across. And dealing with someone like you and your list, it's just a joy because they're savvy, they're interested, and it was just fun. The hour and a half just flew by, Michael.
I told you it would. I appreciate it, John. Look, I know you got a lot going on, and thank you very much again, and hopefully we'll be talking to you next year.
Okay, Michael.
All right, thanks a lot.
It was a pleasure.
Bye. For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com. I hope you've enjoyed this interview with John Carlton. For more information, go to johncarltonoffer.com. That's johncarltonoffer.com.